from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The Supreme Court yesterday opened the door for donors to give more money directly to congressional candidates, mirroring a similar decision from 2010 with the Citizens United case. Supporters say the ruling protects the free speech rights of donors, while critics fear it will give wealthy individuals more influence in politics. We'll discuss the ruling and we'll look at potential impact of it on state and national races next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. The United States Supreme Court lifted a major limit on campaign spending yesterday in what some are characterizing as a sequel to the Citizens United decision, which abolished limits on campaign finance spending by unions and corporations. In McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission, a 5-4 decision along ideological voting lines, the High Court struck down caps on the total amount any individual can contribute to federal candidates over a 2-year election cycle. And in this morning's opening hour of Forum, we hear voices on the decision from both sides, and we find out what the effects of the decision are apt to be, particularly coming up in the midterm elections. Joining us in studio is Joel Richard Paul. He's professor of law at University of California, Hastings Law School. Welcome to the program. Good morning.
Thank you very much.
I also want to welcome Alan Dickerson, who's with us this morning outside of D.C. in Alexandria, Virginia. He's legal director of the Center for Competitive Politics. He wrote the center's amicus brief for McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission. Welcome, Alan Dickerson.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. And I'm going to begin with Joel Richard Paul here in studio. Before we get into debate with you two gentlemen, I thought Joel could, without taking a position here, give us maybe a thumbnail sketch, because there's a good deal of confusion about what actually this means, what this decision means. Can you just give us a crystallization?
Sure. Thank you for having me. McCutcheon was an Alabama businessman who wanted to contribute money to more than 9 candidates for federal office. And under the existing limits, you can only contribute certain amounts of money per candidate. The limits are $1,500 per candidate. You can also contribute about $32,400 to national political campaign committees, $10,000 to any state or local committee, and $5,000 to a political action committee. The total amount under the existing law that you could contribute is $123,000. He wanted to be able to contribute to more than the total number of candidates you could contribute to, which would be 9 candidates under the existing aggregate limits. So he challenged the law, and the Supreme Court, in its opinion yesterday by Chief Justice Roberts, decided that these limits were not justified by Congress's concerns about preventing corruption in the political process. Chief Justice Roberts said that if you can give the maximum amount, $5,200, to 9 people, how is it more corrupting to give $5,200 to a 10th person or a 12th person? And so based on that, he struck down the aggregate limits but left in place the base limits, that is, the amount of money you can give, maximum amount you can give to any one candidate.
So the base limits haven't changed?
The base limits have not changed, and Mr. McCutcheon didn't challenge the base limits. He said he was perfectly comfortable giving no more than $5,200 to any one candidate, but he wanted to be able to give to more than 9 candidates.
So let's get into the debate. And Alan Dickerson, I read where the head of the organization that you're affiliated with, the Center for Competitive Politics, said this is a great day for freedom and for competitive campaigns. But we're hearing many other things from Justice Breyer, for example, who said this is a blow to the First Amendment and American democracy, and Public Citizen, who says it's a devastating blow to our democracy. Lots of people are saying those kinds of things, I think, because they're saying this is, again, too much money in politics, putting too much money in the big megaphone into the ones with the big pocketbooks.
Well, it's always difficult to ask a lawyer for broad policy statements of that sort. I do appreciate that Professor Paul gave, I think, a very fair understanding of what actually happened yesterday. And in terms of, you know, the effects of this on American democracy and on things of that nature, I've heard the debate in the court characterized as a disagreement about what is plausible versus what is possible. I mean, you have – it's been the law since the 70s, shortly after the Watergate scandal, that the only governmental interest that allows for the regulation of this type of money in politics is the danger of corrupting candidates, of actually buying favors. And I think the reason for that is fairly intuitive. It's that if you take a broad enough view of corruption, it tends to shade into some version of what my guys like isn't corrupt and what the other guys, you know, candidates believe in is corrupt. And the court, I think, has been a little bit hesitant to draw a governmental interest that broadly in an area that affects the First Amendment. So if you read the two opinions side by side, I think in many ways a fair way of looking at it is Justice Breyer is very concerned that extremely clever rich people will find ways around the existing bans on the base limits, on the ability to give massive amounts to parties, things of that nature. And the Chief Justice is looking at these arguments and saying, well, that's all very interesting, but there's no evidence of that whatsoever. And it's the government's burden in a First Amendment context to prove that sort of thing. So in my view, again, as a lawyer, I think it's a very helpful opinion in that it says in the future, if we're going to regulate these things, we have to have some sort of evidence, some sort of proof that this particular rule is actually preventing corruption of some sort. And you can't just use sort of broad rhetoric or assumptions to get there.
This brings us back, actually, to the 1976 decision, Buckley versus Vallejo, that set up caps to stave off or keep away corruption, I guess. But doesn't this decision maybe narrow the definition of corruption?
I would say no, in the sense that this has been the view of the court in the majority of their cases, that corruption means quid pro quo corruption, or, you know, think of it a different way. Corruption means the things you can actually throw people in jail for. It's not, you know, this sort of amorphous concept coming out of graduate political philosophy seminars about the ideal society. That's not a justiciable sort of standard. That's not the sort of thing you honestly want judges interpreting, because it's very much in the eye of the beholder. So I would argue that while this opinion is clearer than in previous opinions, you know, this idea that quid pro quo corruption is what matters was certainly present in the majority's opinion in Citizens United, and I would argue as President Buckley itself.
Well, since you did the amicus, I wonder what you say to the fact that there are public polls that still show strong support of caps on campaign spending. 8 in 10 Americans, according to Gallup poll, and 2/3 according to New York Times poll, and that's across all demographics. Is the court really representing the will of the people here?
I just wasn't very kind to political philosophy seminars, but there is the question of whether it's the role of the court, you know, to represent the will of the people as expressed in opinion polls. I think the better example is that the bans on campaign expenditure limits, which are, of course, are separate from the ability to give money to the candidates who then spend the money, that was upheld, you know, I think it was by 8 votes in Buckley, including such luminaries as Justice Brennan and Justice Marshall. So this idea that, you know, the one, that money is important to effective speech, and two, that you have to be careful about how it's done, that has very, very deep roots in the law. Honestly, it wasn't terribly controversial among lawyers until relatively recently. And to the opinion polls, I mean, honestly, I think I would imagine a lot of listeners were somewhat surprised by what Professor Paul said. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what is and isn't legal under the current rules. I can't tell you the number of times I have to explain to people, for instance, that corporations can't give a dime to federal candidates. If they do, it's a criminal act. People have gone to jail for this. So I take your point on the polls, but as you know, with polling, there's a danger of a lack of specificity.
Well, let me go to Professor Paul, John Richard Paul. What are your concerns about this decision?
Sure. Well, there's 2 points that the proponents of federal campaign limits have made about campaign limits. The first point is a concern that some people's voice will be heard more loudly than other people's voice, and that this will drown out the majority and make government less accountable to the people at large. The court in Buckley versus Vallejo said that it wasn't really a legitimate concern of the government to try to redistribute a political voice that way. That is to say, that to take away voice from rich people and to give more voice to people of more modest means. I disagree with the court on that point. But putting that aside, the court in Buckley and in other cases have previously held that there was a concern, a legitimate concern that Congress had about protecting the integrity of the political process. And that means more than quid pro quo. A quid pro quo is just a Latinate phrase for a bribe. And if the concern of Congress had been, in enacting the federal election law, campaign laws, to prevent members of Congress from taking bribes, that would have been unnecessary and superfluous because we have anti-bribery laws. The purpose that Congress had in mind was to protect the larger concern, the appearance that our government was not responsive to people when the government was beholden to those people who had the most money to contribute.
I was reading some wag who was saying if money were speech, bribery would be a constitutional right, but that's just one of those throwaway lines. But
I just want to say, Michael, that changed in Citizens United, and this opinion cuts even further in saying that there's only this very narrow space now that Congress can use to justify these laws, which is, as Alan correctly points out, where there's an actual quid pro quo. And I think that's the most troubling aspect of this opinion, to say that Congress doesn't have more discretion in setting limits on campaign financing.
Isn't there also concern, though, that this will just continue to chip away at limits in terms of political campaign contributions of any kind? I mean, this really changes the terrain.
Yes, it changes the terrain in multiple ways. It means that it is even easier for wealthy people to give money. Under the existing law, a wealthy person could give $123,200 to federal candidates and federal election committees, in addition to which they could give unlimited amounts through super PACs. This makes it even easier for them to give as much as, I think, $2.78 million to all federal candidates in any two-year cycle. That's a lot of money, and the reality is that there are very, very few people who can afford to give that kind of money. I'm not sure we should be so preoccupied with worrying about those people's voice at the expense of everyone else's voice.
Although, an interesting statistic, out of the millions of donors in the 2011-2012 election, only 646 gave the maximum amount, what's now the defunct maximum amount, at Moneta, over $93 million. But that's not a lot of people.
No. That's right. And those people were probably, most of them were probably grateful that there was a limit on the aggregate amount they could give, and they could tell candidates that they were maxed out at some point. There are going to be far fewer people who are going to be able to give the kinds of money that they're now able to give.
Alan Dickerson, what about the concerns we're hearing from Professor Paul?
Well, I think several of them are very real concerns. The difficulty in analyzing a Supreme Court case is always that it's a Supreme Court case. You know, the type of debate you would expect around the legislation itself would probably look different, which is why I think I want to go back to this idea that the court limited the corruption interest essentially to bribes, which I think is in many ways very true, depending on how we want to define bribes. But this goes back to, I think, a very deeply held concern that actually transcends the campaign finance universe. About what exactly the role of prophylactic rules are. And by prophylactic rules, I mean we don't want bribery, or we don't want insider trading, or we don't want some sort of social ill that everyone agrees is a social ill. Those of us who are skeptics of campaign finance regulation, as it's been done, don't want a more corrupt society. We just disagree about how to get there. And I think that's a lot what you're seeing in this opinion. The view of Justice Breyer is that no, you need a large number of highly technical rules and limits, because otherwise there's no way to prevent these sort of corruption issues from coming up. And the Chief Justice's view is, well, actually, we do have criminal laws, and we do have regulatory bodies. We have a Federal Election Commission that can investigate these things. Every single one of the organizations that was implicated by yesterday's ruling has to report its donors to the government. This is a public record. You can go on the FEC's website and look this up. So in that sense, I think you end up with two concerns. If speaking from the court, one is, should we really allow Congress or the government generally to get away from the difficult business of actually proving corruption and building its case and using due process of law to prevent these things? Or should we allow an increasingly large, complex, and easily misunderstood, going back to your poll point, apparatus, which perhaps 1,000 people in this country understand, to regulate our political speech? I mean, there are dangers in that as well from the point of view of the view of legitimacy of the state.
Well, the politics in the wake of this decision are also fascinating. I mean, certainly the Democrats are very critical. The Republicans are pretty happy about it, but that's on the face of it. I think both parties stand to gain. Senator Schumer said they should hold hearings, and Senator McConnell said it shows that Congress can't control the rights of individuals. So there's the divide, but by my lights, at least, the Democratic Party is using it for campaign funding purposes and campaign raising purposes, and that's not necessarily to throw anything their way that's negative. I think it's just the reality of things. We want to bring Sheila Krumholz into this to talk a little bit about the politics. She's executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics and OpenSecrets.org, which actually tracks federal campaign contributions and lobbying activity. Sheila Krumholz, welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. And let's just talk a little bit analytically about what this means in terms of the shape of things. We're going to see certainly an increase in overall campaign spending, but likely maybe channeling away from the super PACs to the parties and the candidates. That's at least what I should dare not call this the smart money, but that's what it seems to be saying. In other words, the parties and the leaders are going to be asserting more discipline over the rank and file and more for PACs and more for party committees.
Yes, I think that's right. I think there is a silver lining here, it perhaps is that parties and party leadership will wrest some control back from the less accountable, more secretive, outside, in quote-unquote, independent organizations, political nonprofits. I do think that if you lament the weakened state of the parties, this could present an upside. But I also think that this is more interested money in the sense that these are donors who have are first of all very wealthy and very often have lots of interests before the government at all levels, and therefore this is a big boon to them. They can give more money directly to those folks who have the ability to deliver on their legislative agenda.
Well, we keep reading about the power of the plutocrats resulting from this decision. Certainly, there's more money in business to give to politics than there is from labor. But, you hear the names like the Koch brothers on the one hand or George Soros on the other hand. This does give them a great deal more clout, doesn't it?
It certainly does. And we're talking about a very tiny elite set of Americans who already have so much influence in Washington. In 2012, roughly 650 people hit the cap, and so far in 2014, it's a couple dozen people. But we're also hearing now that already fundraisers are calling those donors who've maxed out under the old limit and are asking for more money. So this is a meaningful change to those party operatives, to the donors, and to the candidates who will have more funds to work with.
And what about the... Oh, I'm sorry. Please finish your thought.
I was simply going to say, and the big question is, what will those donors want in return, and what will they get?
Well, that again brings up the question of corruption and the old quid pro quo. I mean, to what extent do you see the whole political process being, I'll use the word advisedly, but contaminated by this?
I think this decision takes an already rickety campaign finance system and makes it even weaker. By overturning the aggregate limits, PACs and parties will race to form new committees. We anticipate lots of new distribution hubs known as joint fundraising committees that can take one huge check from wealthy donors to dole it out to all the candidates and parties on their side. And so it adds this new layer of complexity to tracking the money for the press and the public and making sense of how to connect the dots between the money and the influence it buys.
And what do you think this is going to do with the midterm elections? What do you think the impact will be?
Oh, there's no question that we've just injected a lot more money. This will buy lots more ads. And if you were carpet bombed with ads in 2012, get ready, because if you're particularly if you're in a state or a district with a competitive race, especially a Senate race, you know, get ready for more of the same in 2014. Perhaps, again, a silver lining is that these will be ads purchased by the candidates and the parties and less, perhaps more accountable, less deceptive than those run by the outside interest groups, but we'll have those too. So I think we're going to be flooded with ads and advocacy in this election, and some of it will not be so responsible.
Sheila Krumholz, again, is Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics and OpenSecrets.org, which tracks federal campaign contributions and lobbying activity. David McEwen is going to join us now. He's Professor of the Department of Political Sciences at Sonoma State University. And David McEwen, we have you on the line.
Yes, yes, I'm here. Thank you for
having
me. Well,
glad to have you. I think from your perspective, this is a real game changer. You described it as democracy on steroids, but some are saying, nah, it's not really going to be a game changer. Obviously, the big winners are the interest groups here and the plutocrats, perhaps, but does it necessarily change the game?
Well, it begins that process, and the way I think this decision is a game changer is it really kills the principles of transparency and disclosure that began after Watergate, moved through Buckley, and then obviously through Citizens United in this decision. And I think to some degree, it's not hyperbole to argue that campaign finance reform is dead. Ann Revell in the New York Times today wrote about how just the enforcement mechanism and the enforcement system isn't working. We can look in California to what happened with Senator Leland Yee and that whole saga, even though it's different because it's state-level campaign finance reform as opposed to federal. But really what this does is there's a dramatic spillover that occurs across the country and down ballot that affects governance, and I think that's the important component here. It fragments what party leaders can do, the degree to which they can hold their caucus together, because candidate-centered campaigns become much more important. Committee chairs and subcommittee chairs become much more important. That affects parties and their ability to kind of hold the caucus together. That affects the ability to deliver a grand bargain or compromise, and obviously that affects what the government does. And so I think we have a tendency as analysts and political scientists to talk about the sky is falling and really over-exaggerate or push farther the extent of money. It's a necessary but not sufficient condition for campaigns, but it's also about the tone of politics and the effectiveness of governance, and that's where Citizens United really opened the floodgates. And this decision moves even further to really kill campaign finance reform.
Well, we're coming up on a break here, and I want to bring our listeners into this conversation. And in fact, if you would like to join the conversation, you're cordially invited to do that now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. If you'd like to weigh in or if you have questions or comments, feel free to join us now. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, we welcome your calls. Again, the number 866-733-6786. You can also email us. The address, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We'll continue with Joel Richard Paul, professor of law at University of California Hastings Law School, and with Alan Dickerson, legal director of the Center for Competitive Politics. We also have David McEwen on the line, and he's professor in the Department of Political Science at Sonoma State. Feel free to join us. We welcome your calls and emails. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has lifted major limits on campaign spending. Yesterday, they opened the door for donors to give more money directly to congressional candidates, mirroring a similar decision from 2010 with the Citizens United case. And supporters say the ruling protects the free speech rights of donors, and critics fear it will give wealthy individuals more influence in politics. We're discussing the ruling, and we're looking at its potential impact on state and national races with Richard Paul, who's here in studio with us, professor of law at the University of California Hastings Law School, and with Alan Dickerson, who's joining us from Alexandria, Virginia this morning by phone, legal director of the Center for Competitive Politics, and he wrote the center's amicus brief for McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission. We also have David McEwen on the line with us, who's professor of the Department of Political Science at Sonoma State, and you can feel free to join us. I just heard there's a glitch in our website, so you can join us probably until we get that fixed by either tweeting us, our Twitter handle, at KQED Forum, or emailing us, forum at kqed.org, or going to our Facebook page. And let me just go for a moment back to you, David McEwen. Want to hear what your take is on how this is going to affect midterm elections.
Sure. Well, obviously, the models are showing us right now that the House, there's a slight Republican pickup in the House, so that probably remains in Republican hands. The Senate, however, is changing and shifting, and it's a better-than-even chance right now that Republicans pick up anywhere from 4 to 8 seats. So Republicans could take this and use momentum, certainly against Democrats and against Harry Reid, to try to move forward to grab the Senate. If we look even in California, we're going to see this play out not only in some open races that are down south, but also even here in the Bay Area. So if you look at the 17th Congressional District, that's the Mike Honda-Rocana race. That's going to be a very expensive race that just got a lot more expensive because of this ruling. The 33rd race, which is down south, that's who succeeds Howard Berman. Henry Waxman. Yeah. Thank you very much. Who succeeds Henry Waxman is important. And Amy Barra up here in the 7th. So there's going to be a lot more action in California, and that's going to affect even what happens in the Secretary of State's race, which talks about transparency and disclosure and a new framework for California. So this is a huge ruling and a huge impact in California and spinning out to other states. It's California and New York that really are the leaders in campaign finance reform right now, and we'll pay attention to what happens in those states, and it will also obviously affect the midterm elections where Democrats are probably going to suffer quite a bit more than a bloody nose.
David McEwen, good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us this morning on Forum.
Well, thank you for having me, Michael.
And again, David McEwen is professor of Department of Political Sciences at Sonoma State. Let me go right to your calls here, and let's begin with Jason. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yes, I was just basically wondering if your commentators could give a brief history of how money became associated with speech, because I feel like there's a little bit of cognitive dissonance between the fact that, as the Supreme Court justices talked about, you know, if the First Amendment protects Nazi parades in Westboro Baptist Church, on the other hand, you can't really say money is a dumb idea, whereas those people are spouting dumb ideas.
Well, it's a good question, Professor Paul. Can you elucidate that for us?
Sure. In Buckley versus Vallejo, the Supreme Court asserted that money equals speech for purposes of campaign expenditures. Money is considered pure speech. On the other hand, the court, in the same opinion, said that money which is contributed to political candidates is not pure speech. It is rather an associational right. That is, when you contribute to the Republican Party, you're associating yourself with the Republican Party. And that means it's not given quite the same amount of weight in the constitutional balance. What's interesting here is that when we ask ourselves the question, why do we protect speech at all? The First Amendment has a function here. The function of the First Amendment is to facilitate a marketplace of ideas. And a marketplace of ideas, just like an economic marketplace, can only work if it's kept competitive. In order to keep the marketplace competitive, we don't allow, for example, billionaires to buy up all the banks or to buy up all the radio stations. But unfortunately, what the court is saying in McCutcheon is that it's okay for billionaires to buy up all the members of Congress or all the other federal candidates.
There's, a counterpointing view of the First Amendment here, Alan Dickerson, you might want to weigh in on.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I think there's I'd make 2 points where I disagree with Professor Paul. One is, it's a small point, but I think it matters. When the Buckley majority talked about money, it didn't say that money equals speech. What it said was, money is undeniably necessary to effective speech. And I think that that's an obvious point in the sense that, you know, anyone who listens to this station or, you know, our NPR affiliate out here in Washington, you know, is accustomed to the fact that, you know, you're asked for money. And the reason for that is that there's staff salaries, there's overhead. You know, this program doesn't just go out magically from a hat. And there's no difference between, in terms of the logistics of it, that type of speech versus political speech.
Except when you give a candidate money, there's often a maybe unspoken understanding that something will be delivered on your behalf. If people pledge money to NPR or to KQED, that doesn't necessarily carry any quid pro quo. In fact, it doesn't.
It does generally believe that they agree with you or at least like what you're doing. And I think that analogy actually works. The second point is on the antitrust point. Yes, it's true. We don't allow billionaires to buy off all the banks. Actually, more specifically, we don't allow any single billionaire to buy up all the banks. I think one of the things where you might find a lot of agreement across the country politically is that we may allow too many billionaires to buy up the banks, but that's not an antitrust problem. That's a different sort of problem. And the sort of assumption that this is going to help one side versus the other, I think, is wrong in two ways. One is it's not as though all wealthy people are on one side of the spectrum or not, or another, rather. There's a great deal of political diversity in this country that is not always apparent, and it's not at all clear how this is going to work out even in the short run. It's certainly not clear how this is going to work out in the long run. And that's my final point, is that I think it's very dangerous to talk about the effects of constitutional law in terms of, if this year, in this election, are my guys going to win? That's not what the First Amendment is for. It's a dangerous way of thinking. And everyone spends time in the wilderness. Parties are out of power, parties are in power, and you can't have the First Amendment and the way in which our elections are done rewritten depending on who won the last election.
Let me just read a couple of Facebook comments which are apropos to what we're talking about now. Safa writes, money equals speech according to the High Court, and some people just have less speech. Joel writes, this further commoditizes the First Amendment. What sort of access can I ever hope to have to the politicians that represent me with my teacher's salary and one vote? Will I have to rely on the wealthy, which is really the fourth branch of government? Let me get another caller on here. And Barack, that's you.
Good morning, Michael, and folks on the panel. Thank you. So to set the context for my question, I think Citizens United initially was a fairly horrible decision. We've seen the results with the fearsome growth of the super PACs in the last few years. And I would argue that one of the things that has happened is the rapid polarization of politics, in the sense that super PACs tend to be the ones that issue the truly negative advertising, for example, the one that is highly manipulative, in many cases full of lies, and so on. I'm kind of curious as to whether this decision, in a paradoxical way, might work to counterbalance Citizens United by giving more money to the central election commissions, both the GOP and the DNC, in their ability, if you will, to show a more moderate face of politics that might have been before Citizens United came into being.
Okay, we thank you for the question. Professor Paul, want to opine?
Yeah, well, I think that's true, that more money now will be presumably channeled through the official candidates' campaign committees rather than through outside super PACs. But if I can just get back to one other point here, which was raised, and that is that it seems as if the court here is solving a problem that didn't really exist. The court says in its opinion that the First Amendment burden is especially great for individuals who don't have ready access to alternative avenues for supporting their preferred politicians and policies. And it goes on to talk about how some individuals don't have the time to volunteer in the political campaigns of more than one candidate. And so really the concern here seems to be that they want to make it possible for wealthy people to participate in multiple campaigns when those wealthy people don't have time to volunteer. And they go on to say that other effective means of supporting preferred candidates or causes without contributing money are reserved for a select few, such as entertainers capable of raising hundreds of thousands of dollars in a single evening. So it seems as if the court here feels that they have to level the playing field between the Koch brothers and Barbara Streisand. And I think most of us think that's not the real problem in politics.
But let me read a couple of emails, and then we'll go to you, Alan Dickerson, that have a similar theme to them. Lawrence writes, Can the guest clarify the approval to let those that are not direct constituents donate outside of their area or state? Hopefully the gist of this is understood that I, as a California voter, should have no business influencing with money an election in another state. And Scott asks, will this enable what might be called increased federal gerrymandering? It surely seems that the decision will make it much, much easier for the likes of Justice Thomas's friends Sheldon Adelson and the Koch brothers to exert even greater influence in states in which they do not reside. And as a Californian, this is deeply concerning to me. Does anyone else recall then Judge Roberts' pre-Supreme Court interview promised to prevent the Supreme Court from being an activist court? Alan Dickerson.
Oh, that's so many questions.
Well, they kind of combine again into, yeah.
Let me go back to this leveling the playing field point, because I think that's a lot of what's going on here is this sort of worry about who gets the chance to speak and who doesn't. And I think, not that the Chief Justice needs my help, but that that is a concern, but not necessarily in the way that Professor Paul articulated it. If you go back and you read Citizens United, which everyone has an opinion on and about 40 people have read because it's enormous, one of the things that he talks about, Justice Kennedy, who wrote the majority opinion, talks about is that, you know, it's not as though if you were to shut down all the, quote, money in politics, however politics is defined, which is another big issue, that you would suddenly, you know, there'd be no more political debate. What would happen is that certain types of corporations and certain types of speakers would get heard over others. I like to use myself as an example in the sense that I occasionally get invited on radio programs. And so my points get made, and they get made in a way which doesn't cost me any money. So that's part of the concern is that it's not as though the only institutional speakers are rich people and politicians. There's also, you know, a corporate and a highly diffused, you know, media presence, which endorses candidates, which talks about political issues, which, you know, gets its points out. And that's entirely outside of the campaign finance sort of infrastructure. And that's one of the things that has concerned the court all along is that, you know, it's not as though, you know, the Sheldon Adelsons of the world are the only people influencing politics. Media personalities certainly influence politics. If you keep reading the footnote that Professor Paul pointed out, you know, there's a reference to Jay-Z concerts that are used for fundraising purposes. So I think there's this danger of treating campaign finance as some sort of free speech ghetto, when in fact it's part of the overall whole of how a diversified message gets into the marketplace of ideas. And I think there's a tendency to ignore the role of non-quote political speakers in that process. And I don't think the majority ignores that problem.
This may be the first time historically that the Supreme Court has brought into rhetoric Jay-Z and Barbara Streisand. But let me bring in some more callers here, and we'll go to you, Rajiv. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I agree completely with the premise that the common person does not have enough of a voice when it comes to campaign financing. And the best idea I've heard to actually reform this is for the government to give each person a voucher for maybe $100. And each person can then decide for himself or herself which political candidate or party that they would like to donate that voucher to. And it seems like this could create a massive fund of money which candidates could then try to draw from instead of having to go to billionaires and corporations to raise money. I was wondering what your panel might have thought about this proposal.
Well, we thank you for the call. A proposal for – we're talking a little bit about policy here rather than the law, but – It brings up another kind of ancillary question. I'd like to hear maybe what you have to say on this. We'll go to Alan Dickerson on this. But also, Congress could have – I'm looking at an email here from a listener named Scott who says, well, if the poll says 8 out of 10 people don't like money in politics, then don't lawmakers have the opportunity to rewrite the law that satisfies the voters? Indeed, that was what was supposed to happen with McCain-Feingold. But there's an opportunity again, I suppose, to have Congress take up the gauntlet here.
I mean, certainly Congress's powers exist, and that's largely the point. The point is that it's not that you can't do anything about these concerns. The point is that you have to do it in a way that's constitutional. And a lot of the problem is that we hear all this rhetoric about who's buying our democracy or whatever else, and you see extraordinarily little evidence of how this plays out. And certainly in court, which is where I normally am, I'm not a professor, you know, it's remarkable how little evidence the state feels it needs to bring forward to justify a limit on this sort of political association. And I think that raises two points. One is, you know, what this opinion does is forces the government to create an evidentiary record for how these sort of limits are a good fit to what they're trying to accomplish. That it's not a sledgehammer when a scalpel will do. And I think that goes back to the caller's question, which I think is very interesting. I mean, my organization has actually been on the record saying that, in our case, a tax credit rather than a voucher, but it worked out more or less the same way, would be fine. In the sense that, you know, the problem is that you don't want people putting a thumb on the scale. You don't want the people who are currently in power trying to create a system where they have unfair advantages. And I certainly think that that's the type of thinking. How can we do this in a way that isn't an attempt to shut the other guy up, but nonetheless leads to greater participation and greater thinking that hopefully this opinion will engender? You know, hopefully the fact that, you know, you can't just use rhetoric to get your way anymore in the high court will mean that people will think seriously about alternatives. And I think the caller raised one of the leading alternatives.
Joel Paul.
Conservatives generally believe that the courts should defer to Congress when Congress passes legislation, and should only intervene in exceptional cases where the Congress is in some way distorting the political system. It seems to me in this instance, Congress has done extensive fact-finding. They've come to conclusion. Unlike the justices, they have to work within the political system. They have a much better sense of the burden that all this fundraising has imposed on the political system and the ways in which it has had a corrupting effect. To insist that you have to present evidence the way you would in a court of law to somehow persuade the justices that Congress did its homework properly, I think is unreasonable. And I would just draw up one sort of contrast here. The Supreme Court, in a case called Crawford versus Marion County Board of Elections, upheld Indiana's law, which requires people to vote, who vote, to present some kind of photo identification issued by the government, like a passport or a driver's license. The plaintiffs in that case argued that this would unfairly burden poor people and senior citizens and people who don't drive. And the court in that opinion said, well, that's a hypothetical problem, and until you have proof, we're not going to accept that. In this instance, the court is saying, and yet in that case, obviously, it certainly did burden people's ability to participate in the political process. In this case, the court also is engaging in a series of hypotheses about how the existing ruling could somehow be managed without having a corrupting effect on the political process. That doesn't seem to me to be the court's role. It seems to me it ought to be up to Congress to make those laws and to see if those laws can fit. And this is the law that Congress came up with.
Let me bring in more of your calls. We'll go to Berkeley. Jimmy, you're on. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Okay.
So anyway, my whole point is that really we're having the issue of too much money in politics when really the main issue of money in politics, we can't get money out of politics. I mean, it really clearly stated by Mayor Amschel Rothschild, he said, "Give me control of a nation's money supply, and I care not who makes his laws." So my question is, why is it that the Congress feels that it has any right to affect someone's First Amendment right to freely associate? And if a person, an individual, has the right to freely associate, then why not a group of individuals, such as outlined in a charter for corporations? Why is there a distinction in that? And as well, why is there any legal precedence for regulation on how much is speech and how are these arbitrary lines drawn? Why is $126,000 okay, but anything more than that is corrupt? It doesn't make any sense on a philosophical basis to me, and I was wondering if you could clarify that.
Let me go to Joel Paul.
Well, Congress makes laws all the time that restrict freedom of speech, as it does other constitutional liberties. The question isn't can Congress make laws that restrict those rights. It's rather what kind of justification does Congress have to offer? In this case, the Supreme Court said in Buckley versus Vallejo that Congress had to show that it had an important government interest and that this was substantially related to the achievement of the important government interests. On that basis, the court in Buckley versus Vallejo upheld these aggregate limits that the court overturned yesterday. So this is nothing, there's nothing unusual at all about Congress of the United States or any state legislature passing laws that restrict our freedom of speech. We impose limitations all the time. You can't walk into a bank and say, hand me your money. You can't issue a proxy statement that's filled with misrepresentations. You can't threaten the life of the president. You can't get on an airplane and demand that they fly someplace else.
I'm getting a lot of emails, and I want to read some of them. People want to weigh in here with their opinions, so let me go through some of these. Rick in Palo Alto says, I hear a lot about wealthy individuals influencing, but nothing about the enormous influence of unions. Certainly these organizations have influence. Pam says, I wonder if any legislature has tried to restrict campaign money so that it could only come from residents of the district electing the official, and how would this fly in the courts? Seems to me that the government does have a compelling interest in assuring representative democracy, and it's hardly representative to have outside district interests having such an enormous influence on who is elected. Bill says, how close is the correlation between money spent in elections won? It didn't help Romney. Richard says, your speaker misconstrues the arguments against this 5-4 decision. It isn't a victory for either the Republicans or the Democrats, but a loss for the average voter who can't bring large amounts of money to get attention. This case has to be seen in light of the efforts to curb voting rights. This case makes it more likely that more voters will just stay at home because they believe, maybe correctly, that their vote does not count. And Bill writes, starting with the judicial coup d'etat in 2000, the court has made itself a super legislature, repealing laws enacted by Congress if repeal benefits business and Republicans. Conservatives used to complain about the court making the law. They don't complain anymore. Antoine writes, the problem with the two decisions is with Citizens United, the companies who are now considered people do not have to ask the permission of the people who work for them when making contributions. The people are not represented, only the company. The current decision allows for a very few people to have influence on many elections across the U.S. that may in turn influence federal law and not just state or district. And Steve writes, I've always thought that Buckley versus Valeo never made any sense to equate money to speech in order for a representative democracy to function properly. A rich man's wallet can't be equated to a poor man's soapbox, and all citizens must have equal amounts of speech and access. Without spending limits, wealthy people will always have the ability to have more speech than anyone else. There's that argument again, Alan Dickerson, and you say what?
Well, I want to start with this idea that, you know, people are going to check out of the process, because this is something that's been articulated by a number of the justices on the court, and I think it's the sort of thing that you know, those of us who are again skeptical of these regulations need to take seriously. And my answer is sort of related to this idea that very few people are wealthy enough to do this, and it's also related to this idea about, well, what about the political influence of unions, which is very real and palpable. And I think that this comes down to a simple fact about organized society, and that is that organizations and groups of people are always more powerful than individuals, and that in the influence of a few billionaires is certainly canceled out, or at least mitigated, depending on where you stand on these things, by the existence of civil society, by the existence of unions, of the Sierra Clubs and NRAs of the world, which wield enormous power, not on the basis of individual wealth, but on the basis of a widespread support, both in terms of people who vote based on those recommendations and in terms of, you know, fundraising. And so I think that's part of the problem, is that there's this tendency to view campaign finance differently from regular politics. In regular politics, everyone understands that it's a majority that rules. There have been some fairly prominent Republican statewide candidates in California that spent enormous sums of money, vastly outspending their opposition. The sitting governor nonetheless won, despite those disparities. So my suggestion would be that those people who are worried about checking out of politics based on these things go back to the roots of politics, which are the membership associations, which are the unions, which are the, you know, the super PACs, which honestly were created, if you read the opinion that created them, were created to allow small individuals to do what billionaires have always been able to do, namely run ads by aggregating and bringing their money together.
Well, I'm looking at a couple of other emails here that I just want to get on the record. William writes, oh, come on. Every campaign contribution has some expectation of something in return, and that is a quid pro quo relationship between the donor and the politician. If I donate $2,500 to a politician, then you're damn right. I would expect my voice to be heard by him or her. And another email from Michael in San Francisco writes, I pay a disproportionate amount of my income, 50% in taxes, which the general population and lawmakers force upon me. Why shouldn't I have the option of leveraging campaign donations to voice my opinion against having to carry even more burden? Let me bring some more calls in here. And let's go to you, Carrie, in San Jose. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to hear what your guests think about the notion that this adds more polarization to the system, because my view is that each time one of these rulings comes down that allows more money and more concentrated money, that it gives more power to the polar ends and to the existing structures and creates more polarization and gets away from the fundamentals of what politics is supposed to be all about, which is creating policy to fulfill human needs and community needs.
What do you think, Professor Paul, more polarization?
I don't think it necessarily leads to more polarization. What it's going to lead to is more control by party leaders, particularly leadership in the House and leadership in the Senate, because they will be the ones who will be administering, presumably, these joint campaign committees.
And a last question for you as we head toward wrapping up here, Alan Dickerson. A listener named Raphael wants to know, are there other cases on the Supreme Court docket that will further weaken limits? And I guess that really addresses the bigger question that many people feel, that this is just the start of, again, chipping away at all limits.
I am not aware of any cases dealing with campaign contributions that are on the court's docket. The only other political speech case that's really being seriously considered is an Ohio ban on untrue, quote-unquote, political speech, which the court, I believe, has already heard arguments on, and we should expect a decision in June.
Well, we will continue to follow this, obviously, and to one extent, thanks to you, Alan Dickerson. And again, Alan Dickerson is legal director of the Center for Competitive Politics, and he wrote the Center's amicus brief for McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission. Thanks to Joel Richard Paul, who joined us in studio, professor of law at University of California Hastings Law School. And thanks also to Sheila Krumholz, executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics, who joined us in this program. And David McEwen, professor of the Department of Political Science at Sonoma State, who also joined us. You can join us every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And you can continue this discussion on our website, assuming everything is going on that, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our interns are Jack Detch, Marisa Endicott, Mariam Jamil, Hannah Rose Levy, Audrey Gertz, and Daniel Radin. Another hour up ahead, we're going to talk to a famous rock and roll photographer. Stay tuned for that. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.